Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Passing Shot with Joel and Kim, sponsored by DownloadTennis.com. On today's Tour Catch-Up,
Novak Djokovic claims his 38th Masters title with victory in Rome.
Iga Świątek seals her fifth straight title.
And Wimbledon is set to lose its ranking points.
Kim, today is the 15th of May and we are here to catch up on the week in tennis at Passing Shot HQ. We are recording a little earlier than usual. We are coming off the finals day in Rome. Novak Djokovic is your men's champion. Iga Świątek is your ladies champion. And we're going to be catching up on all the events that has happened in Rome this week. It has been a fun tournament. There have been fans there. It's been very, very boisterous, very energetic from the crowd, which we love to see. But Kim, of course, it's not been the only event in Italy this week that has caught the eye and the conversation of us at Passing Shot HQ, because we had Eurovision last night. And I know you absolutely love Eurovision as much as you love tennis and Rafa and, you know, podcasting with me, obviously. So let's talk about Eurovision very, very quickly, because it was in Turin, wasn't it? Which is, I kept telling people last night, that's where the tennis gets played for the tour finals at the end of the season.
Yeah, you know, I'm surprised they didn't mention it on the show because it's such an important fact.
I was telling everyone. That was like my one fact for the evening.
And I'm sure it'll be transformed very quickly, you know, back from being a big stage for a, you know, global entertainment show off to, you know, tennis courts come November. But yeah, great, great show. Really, really good showing from the United Kingdom. So that was, I think in my sort of adult lifetime, the best that we've ever done.
It was dream world. It was like, I feel like how bad we are at Eurovision is one of those statistics that was sort of talked about in the sort of same sort of realms as like X number of years since we've had a British Wimbledon male champion.
Yeah, we always like to like give it a bit of time before things happen again. But hopefully, you know, onwards and upwards now for us in Eurovision. But and, you know, a Ukrainian victory, which I'm sure, you know, you can't really begrudge that with everything that's going on. It was a very strong message of solidarity with Ukraine. So, yeah, all in all, a very good show. Eurovision is one of my highlights of the year. And I'm sure some of our listeners don't care about Eurovision, so we won't dwell on it too much. But yeah,
I don't think one of those people was the DJ at the finals today, because he was playing it on the changeover, the Ukraine song.
Yeah, I was watching Świątek and Gabor and I heard the sort of chorus in the background as the coverage was on. So yeah, obviously already getting played across Europe, and I'm sure, well, you know, it'd be interesting to see who, well, if any of the tennis players bothered watching it on Saturday night, or if they were getting an early night, because it does go on quite late and they probably had other things to do in advance of the finals. But I mean, let's get on to the tennis, I suppose, if we have to. Let's start with Novak, because we've just seen him win the final against Stefanos Tsitsipas in straight sets. It was in the end very, very one-sided to begin with. Novak did manage to bagel Tsitsipas in that first set, but I was convinced it was going to go to a third when Tsitsipas, you know, went up a break or two in the second set. It was 5-2 up, and then Novak managed to claw it back. It went to a tie break, and the rest is history. Djokovic doing what he does best and clinching it in straight sets.
Yeah, it was a very impressive second set, I think, particularly from Novak Djokovic. Stefanos Tsitsipas didn't really seem to be at the races in that first set. In particular, his first and second serve, Djokovic was just climbing all over it. And it was shades of Karolina Pliskova, I think, from Tsitsipas, you know, in that first set. But, you know, he did kind of find his rhythm in that second set. He certainly found his serving and made life a lot more difficult you know, for Novak Djokovic. And he really had to, I think, you know, dig deep in the sense of, you know, Tsitsipas, I think, was serving for that second set at 5-2, Djokovic coming back, getting to a tiebreak. And I mean, Tsitsipas's record in tiebreaks has been pretty decent, you know, this season. But Djokovic was able to kind of come through. 38th Masters crown. He's now registered over 1,000 ATP Tour victories. That was his 1,001 victory. And yeah, it seems to be that he is very much kind of peaking at the right moment for, you know, the French Open, because, you know, we go back to Belgrade and really kind of only just really kind of a few weeks ago. And he really was, I feel like, struggling through matches. There are lots of three set, you know, victories, real kind of up and down, lacking, I felt, kind of consistency. And, you know, this tournament, it's been a complete, almost kind of breath of fresh air in the sense, I think, for his clay season, in the sense of, you know, he didn't drop a set throughout the week. And, you know, when he came up against really hard opponents who were bringing some really, really good tennis, in particular, you know, his quarterfinal against Felix Auger-Aliassime, and then Casper Ruud as well in that semi-final, he really brought a level of tennis that I just don't think we have seen so far in the clay season. And as I said, I think it bodes really, really well for him with the French Open just around the corner.
Yeah, I mean, we go back to his match against like Alejandro Davidovich Fokina in Monte Carlo, and then all those struggles he had in Belgrade, and the final with Rublev, where he just kind of had no energy in that third set. And like, he seems to be back where he needs to be, like the Novak of old. And I think, you know, it only took him, you know, a bit of time, a few tournaments. He's played his way in, got better as it's, you know, as it's progressed with each tournament. So absolutely where he wants to be. And we know that Rome plays quite similarly to the clay at Roland Garros. So I think he'll be absolutely delighted to have come away with a title here, not dropping a set. Weak to Roland Garros, you know, one of his closest rivals, you know, Rafa's obviously having injury troubles, which are chronic and ongoing. So I think if you're on Team Novak at the moment, I think things are looking very much on the up and looking like he's got a good chance to defend his title from last year. And
does it put him as a favourite, do you think?
I would say so. I mean, just because of what Rafa's kind of come out and said after his match against Shapovalov, and the way that, you know, he just wasn't really able to compete in that third set with Shapovalov, you know, his foot that he, it's an ongoing injury that he lives with. And it just, he said, you know, it wasn't really playable for him. He, like halfway through that second set, he just couldn't really do anything. And he's just constantly in pain, essentially. And I've struggled to see how he'd be able to get through seven best of five matches to win Roland Garros. Obviously, I hope that he can manage it and do. I'm sure he'll give it absolutely his everything. Like, we know that he's going to try his absolute hardest. You know, he's an absolute fighter. So, but I just think being realistic, it's looking like, I guess, Djokovic. And then I suppose if it's not Djokovic and Rafa's foot is still bad, we'll get onto this in our preview pod, but, you know, Alcaraz, et cetera, would be the others. But, you know, in going back to Rome this week, yeah, I think Djokovic just, no one really had an answer. I suppose Felix probably came the closest in that match. It was two tight sets in the quarterfinal.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, what's amazing, I think, for Djokovic is that, you know, this was his first tour title in 6 months. You know, he's not, you know, for reasons, you know, most fans know about Australia, you know, not getting access into the United States. It's been a very kind of stop start couple of months, you know, the start of the season. And, you know, it's taken him this time, I think, to kind of find his feet, get those, you know, back-to-back kind of tournaments in. And I really think kind of having the Masters back-to-back high-level tennis, you know, Masters 1000 events, I think has actually really helped him in the sense of he's been able to kind of put, you know, a string of matches together. And, you know, he's had some really high-intensity, highly competitive matches, you know, thinking particularly about that Alcaraz match, which he lost on a, you know, a tiebreaker last week in Madrid. But I think the nature of these tournaments being back-to-back has actually helped him in the sense of it's shown kind of what he needs, and he's just been able to kind of get minutes on court, and he's just been playing some very, very good tennis. And I think, you know, this week in particular, I think his forehand has been one of those shots I think has been particularly improved upon over, you know, over the last few weeks. I just think, you know, going back to, you know, Belgrade, I just remember this being just so many sort of uncharacteristic errors, unforced errors from the back of the court, particularly from the forehand. But it just was not on show, I think, really today. And, you know, that first set, he just blitzed Tsitsipas. He just was kind of went three love up. Tsitsipas was getting really, really frustrated. Tsitsipas got warning for hitting, you know, his bag with the tennis racket, which again was not a good look because there was a ball kid standing behind the bag with an umbrella to kind of protect Tsitsipas from the sun on the changeover. But again, it was not a great look, but he just showed kind of the frustration already that he was feeling. And it was because Djokovic, he was not messing around. He came on court. He knew what he wanted to do. And Tsitsipas didn't really have an answer. And, you know, in particular, I just felt kind of his backhand, it just didn't have the pace or, you know, didn't have the threat enough, I think, to really kind of trouble Djokovic. And it was easy for Djokovic to get ahead in the rally, particularly with how Tsitsipas was serving in that first set. And although Tsitsipas did make more of it in the second set, I think, yeah, he will be disappointed he didn't push it to a third, because I think, Kim, if there was one thing that Tsitsipas would have looked to have done, you know, in that match that would have been a confidence booster for Roland Garros, would have been taking it to a third and doing that from a point of such adversity, given, you know, I got bageled in the first set, because, you know, their last match was the French Open final when Tsitsipas was two sets up, Djokovic came back and won in five. And it was just sort of like, you know, that was adversity that Djokovic was able to overcome. And Tsitsipas, you know, in a best of three format, he almost had the opportunity here, I think, to show, actually, I can put that to one side and I can give you a real run for your money and potentially take you to a third and we'll see what happens. But unfortunately, he just wasn't able to do that today.
Yeah, I think he'll be rueing the fact he just wasn't able to get to that third set. I mean, I still think that Djokovic would have won in three, but it would have been like just great for a, you know, neutral fans as well to have a third set.
I think that's why Djokovic was getting angry, like in the second set. I think the crowd was sort of a bit frustrated with, you know, with the match itself, given it was not really a spectacle. You know, it was already, you know, we'd already had kind of one underwhelming, you know, Masters final last week in Madrid, which just crawled over the hour mark. And it was looking very much like a very similar possibility, I think, 2 weeks running. And I think that the crowd were kind of sensing that and were trying to G up kind of Tsitsipas and feed him some energy. And Djokovic, I think, was beginning a little bit frustrated with that. And it was interesting to see that sort of dynamic, I think, play out across the two sets.
Yeah, for sure. And I think going into Roland Garros, depending on the draw and if these two will meet, whether that's in a semi or a final again, you know, I think it would have been good for Tsitsipas to have taken this to three, because I do wonder if maybe that will, just the fact that he was 5-2 up, not able to take it to a third, whether that would come into play in their next match, which may very well be very soon. But, you know, overall, I think he'll be glad that getting to the final, you know, he got kind of revenge over Zverev for his defeat in Madrid. So making it through to the final, beating everyone else on his path, you know, Sinner, Khachanov, etc., Dimitrov, so some good wins along the way. Toughy though with Dimitrov early on, it was, but came through.
It's interesting because, you know, Tsitsipas, you know, apart from you know, obviously losing to Djokovic in the final today, he's probably had arguably the most consistent, you know, results as the European clay swing has begun. You know, he obviously started with a title in Monte Carlo, and he sort of carried that form through. Yes, he lost to, was it Carlos Alcaraz, I think, in the quarters in Barcelona. But, you know, he has been very consistent, but sort of at the same time, a little bit, I feel like, underwhelming. I still feel like when I've seen him in these sort of big matches, there's still that sort of air of vulnerability. And as you said, it could have been a very different story this week, because, you know, he had to save match points against Dimitrov in his opening match, which was, you know, great for him obviously to come through. But it doesn't feel like I've seen the clay tennis of him this year that I think I've seen him have the season before that. I think there's still like a level he can go up to, and I think it's a level that he needs in order to kind of harbour serious ambitions of winning a Grand Slam, because I do think Clay does help his game. I think, you know, there are weaknesses to the Tsitsipas game, but I think Clay sort of masters them and actually kind of helps him. But at the same time, if he's going to want to go through Novak Djokovic and win your first kind of Grand Slam title, I think he's going to need to still rediscover that form that sort of took him there last season. Because even though I've seen him get to kind of finals, you know, play well on the clay swing so far, it still doesn't feel like we're quite there yet.
Yeah, he's gone a bit under the radar despite fairly consistent results and that title in Monte Carlo. I think we have been focusing our attention on the likes of Alcaraz and also Novak and Rafa as usual. So in my mind, I feel like Tsitsipas has sort of just, yeah, it's gone through it, but not in the most convincing of fashion. So, but I guess maybe that's also a testament. We kind of expect him to do well on the clay after his, you know, excellent clay season last year and the final of Roland Garros.
I mean, arguably, the fact that I would say he's not been playing as well as, you know, he has been, I think, in previous seasons on the clay, and yet he's still making, you know, Masters Series finals, does potentially bode well if he can find that extra gear. But, you know, you see those matches against, you know, for example, Dimitrov in the second round. Again, there's still that sort of, you sort of wonder if, you know, there are players out there who can cause him trouble, you know, early on in the tournament. So, yeah, I think he'll be looking to find that sort of extra gear in order to really kind of take it to Djokovic and really kind of push him, you know, at a point where I still think, you know, Djokovic is a little bit vulnerable in the sense of he's had that stop start timing to the, you know, the season so far. This has just been, you know, one tournament. We'll remember this is his first title win in the last 6 months. So I don't think it's like all is right in the world because Novak Djokovic has won Rome. Yes, this is a very, very special tournament to him. He feels right at home here. It was almost kind of interesting to hear, I think, in his post-match, in the post-match ceremony, how he almost sort of expected everything to come together right in Rome, given, you know, how well he likes the conditions and his kind of previous, you know, his previous efforts at the tournament as well. But, you know, I do think that there's still kind of opportunities there for other players to potentially take him over. But, you know, he is going in, I think, as the clear favourite and, you know, with a bunch of kind of people, unfortunately, probably including Rafa in the rear view in that sort of second outsider group just under Novak.
Yeah, I think you've got to go with experience and form. And, you know, I just think, and if Rafa wasn't struggling with his foot, I'd put him right up there with Novak.
Yep.
But given the realities of the situation, I think Djokovic is definitely the most likely candidate.
Do you think Tsitsipas is second runner-up? Or do you think it's just a group of people, including Alcaraz, Zverev, Tsitsipas, Rude?
Well, I don't think I'd put Rude in the category just yet.
Okay.
He hasn't got the same calibre at slams yet. I'd say Tsitsipas and Alcaraz would be the two kind of behind Djokovic, but who knows, perhaps we'll get a surprise. I mean, I just, on other results this week, Joel, I had Cameron Norrie in the semi-finals, but he lost to Marin Cilic. What was going on there? It was three sets, but 6-1 in the third. I was quite bemused by that result, I have to say.
I mean, Norrie was, I think he was a set and a break up, and then Cilic just sort of ran away with it, and Norrie really didn't have an answer in that third set. But yeah, it was a interesting result. I mean, for British fans, it was probably the best it got. Obviously, we didn't have Andy Murray, you know, Dan Evans, not particularly great. I thought he would do a little bit better against Bashilashvili, but unfortunately, no. So yeah, it was a bit, I think, disappointing on the British front. I mean, I know you spoke about Rafa, his foot. Is there, it felt like a funeral, I feel like, amongst Rafa fans on Twitter when that was coming about. You know, the way I sort of see it, Kim, is like, this is not a new injury. It's an existing one. As you said, it's chronic, and he should be able to find a way to, glass half full here, but hopefully he can find a way in order to kind of manage it at, you know, Roland Garros for 2 weeks of the year. And, you know, yes, he's got to play 7 best of 5 set matches, but I don't think he's not going to need to be 10 out of 10 across all 7 of those matches. And I think I still think there's I still think he is in with a shout, but it's obviously not great when you see on the TV him sort of limping. And, Shapovalov did obviously make the most of it. But I just feel like now with Rafa, we've not really seen Rafa be beaten like tennis for tennis. Shapovalov's won, and, Rafa's foot's sort of been hurting. Taylor Fritz as well in that final in Indian Wells. Lloyd Harris before that as well. It does feel like a little bit of a recurring theme. And that maybe for me is probably the biggest worry.
Yeah, I think it's his body, isn't it? That's his biggest battle enemy. It's when Rafa's fully fit and firing. We saw how good he was the start of this year. I mean, obviously he still had the foot injury then, but was able to, I guess, manage it better than it keeps rearing its ugly head right now. And I think for a lot of Rafa fans, I guess we sort of feel that it really peaked in the Australian Open this year, that sort of miracle of him winning that final from two sets down. I just still can't believe that actually happened. So I feel sort of comforted by the fact that we had such a fantastic result and start to the season. And yeah, it's struggling a bit now, but we live in hope. I just, I don't like knowing that he's in pain. It's obviously, you don't want anyone to be in pain, but these sports people at elite level, they go through so much for their sport. And, he's not the only one that has chronic injuries that he's dealing with. And we've seen this so many times in other sports. And, it's just, he's going to have his doctor with him in Paris. So, and he's going to give it his all. We know that.
Get the magic spray on, Kim. Get the magic spray on.
Tons and tons of painkillers, I think, is what he's already on. But yeah, it's going to have to hope that some secret, got some tricks up his sleeve, maybe. But we'll see how it goes in Paris. Just a note on the doubles in Rome as well. We had a title for Mektic and Pavic. They are back to winning ways. It's their first title of the season, actually. And they beat the Isner man duo of John Isner and Diego Schwartzman, who paired up, much to everyone's delight. 12-10 in the championship tiebreak. So maybe it proves that, although they didn't quite win, having little and large together, obviously it's almost a winning partnership. Maybe there'll be more kind of height differences matching up soon.
I mean, it was it was a really I watched that championship tiebreak, and they had opportunities to win it. It was a really entertaining match. I think a lot of us were looking at that pairing and just seeing it more for comedic value. We didn't actually think they were going to go all the way through to the final, but they went and did that. They had a very good win, I saw, against Cabal and Farah en route. Yeah, a little bit, I think, disappointed they couldn't get it done. But at the same time, for Mektic and Pavic, a team who, they won 9 titles last season on the doubles circuit. And, we're now in mid-May, and this was their first one. So I think they'll be a little bit relieved going into the French Open and actually have a title in their locker. But for Isner and Schwartzman, Kim, are you hoping to see this again? Because I feel like all the crowds want to see it. Do you think that could be do you think we'll see them at the French Open?
Well, if they've got good chemistry and the crowd are loving them and they're having good results, then why on earth not? It's certainly, John Isner's not usually a player that I sort of gravitate towards watching, but I'm more inclined to if he's paired up with someone like Diego Schwartzman in the double. So yeah, I think could be a good team.
Are we going to get more people taking inspiration from this? I'm seeing Riley Opelka and Sebastian Baez teaming up. Are we going to see more big height differentials on the double circuit, do you think?
Yeah, well, quite possibly. If it's they've got to come up with a catchy team name. Like, I think they decided Isner man.
Yes.
So yeah, I don't know how you've got to have a catchy team name, but that was a good win for Mektic and Pavic. I'm sure they'll be pleased that they've got a title and going into the French as well. Maybe they'll be looking to go deep there. But we do have, obviously, the women's side of things as well, which was, well, again, I think my prediction, I think your prediction as well, everyone's prediction came true. Iga Świątek winning yet another title, yet another Masters 1000 title. It's her fifth title on the trot, her 28th victory on the trot as well. coming through again in another final with the loss of just four games, 6-2, 6-2 over on Jabeur. I mean, what did you make of this? She was, again, just very convincing. She's just playing so well. I don't really have much more to say.
Yeah, it was another great week, similar to Djokovic. Didn't drop a set, was still handing out baked goods, bagels, breadsticks, throughout the week. She was, she was tested at times. I feel like particularly, against Azarenka in that first set, and then in that first set as well against Andreescu, which went to a tiebreak, really, really long set. But no one seems to be able to kind of live with her over two sets and keep up kind of that consistency. And she's just, running away with it at the moment. And in the final, again, it started very, very quickly for Świątek. I really love how when she has got on court, she's, she's all business and straight to the, she's straight to it. And she's caught her opponents, I think, a little bit cold. And in the final, I think, yes, there were sort of mitigating circumstances for Jabeur. She had a late, she had the night match against Kasatkina in the semi-final where she had to save match point. She came back from the near depths of defeat against Sakkari as well in her quarterfinal. I think she was like, 6-1, 5-2 down, and she came through that second set 7-5 before running away with it 6-1 in the decider. So I think, by the time she had got to that final, I think she was potentially a little bit fatigued. She's played a full clay season. She got to the Madrid Open final, last week and won it. So she's played a lot of tennis, and perhaps it caught up with her a little bit in the final. But at the same time, Świątek was just playing some absolutely lights out tennis. And although I think Jabeur, there was that game, I think, when Świątek was, I think she was like 5-2 up. And, there were moments where Świątek could have come out, at 4-love. Świątek came back and could have got it to back on serve. But Świątek just too strong at the moment.
Yeah, I think Jabeur had like three break points to break back in that second
Those
set,
were but amazing points, by the way.
But yeah, wasn't able to do it. And then from there, it was kind of like, routine. I don't normally, when players are dominating, people might think, oh, it's a bit boring. But I just think it's amazing what Świątek's doing, and I'm really enjoying it. And I hope her streak lasts as long as possible, because it's just lovely to see, isn't it? I think it's the fourth longest women's win streak since 2000. So she's, going right up there. And I mean, she is the overwhelming favourite, I guess, for Roland Garros, given the fact that she's won it before. She's on this incredible win streak.
Is it a surprise if she doesn't win it?
I think so. But then I just feel like, is there going to be like a lot of pressure and hype? So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's more likely that someone would upset her. I think she could still go out in like the fourth round. I wouldn't be surprised. Okay. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I remember when Świątek beat Halep, and Halep was the kind of strong favorite to win Roland Garros in that particular time. And I think we do have to be careful about sort of saying, oh, she's dead cert for the victory, but she's certainly going in the right way and seems to be very comfortable and happy with everything. Although when she won today, she was very, very emotional. And, you sort of might think that winning so much, she'd just be a bit like blasé, but she's clearly not taking it for granted. She was very, sobbing on the court at the end. So it's obviously has taken her a lot to get to this point. I don't know, maybe there's something else going on. I'm not sure. But yeah, it was interesting to see how much it meant to her.
Yeah, it was, it was a very, very impressive tournament for her, and it was impressive, I think, also for Jabeur, because I think what I've found interesting, I feel like we can wheel out like an episode's worth of stats about how amazing kind of Świątek is at the moment, and what she's doing for women's tennis, what she could potentially do for women's tennis, in terms of it feels like she, and the way she is playing at the moment, she is here to kind of really elevate the game in a way. Potentially a rivalry between Świątek and Barty could have done. Obviously, we're not able To have that given Barty's retirement. But Świątek still on her own, I think, can really kind of raise the profile of women's tennis. And I almost don't feel like we're like talking enough about it. You know, these records, I feel like if they happened in the men's game, for example, we would thinking, well, like, guys, this is like, you know, this is like Roger Federer, but better than Roger Federer. Like, it feels like that sort of level of, you know, ruthlessness that she's playing with at the moment. And maybe because the matches are so easy, we're just sort of taking it for granted. And I do wonder if, like, I sort of do think that they're, you know, the rest of the locker room on the tour, I do think there is more there that I think there is more competition there. I still don't think we've seen the best of players that, you know, I sort of expect to give Świątek more a run for her money. Like, for example, in the semi-final against Sabalenka, Świątek won 6-2, 6-1. I'm sort of expecting a lot more from Sabalenka. And again, players like Azarenka and Andreescu, you know, they've shown that they've got it in them, I think, to give Świątek a run for her money, particularly with, you know, the first set. But it sort of kind of got away from them. And, you know, I think there's still plenty more. I think these kind of top players in the, you know, the higher echelons of the rankings, I think can give potentially and need to give a bit more. And then perhaps that pressure might tell on Świątek.
Yeah, I think also Grand Slams can be different beasts, can't they? You've got, you know, certain conditions and crowds. So you can always, there's always the possibility for an upset from whoever. But yeah, certainly someone like Sabalenka, you know, you would expect, given that she's so highly ranked, that she's not going to be losing 6-2, 6-1 to the world number one. That shouldn't really be happening in the sense that it shouldn't be so uncompetitive. But, you know, she's had a difficult year. She hasn't been particularly in good form. So actually to get to the semi-final, I think was actually a victory in itself for Sabalenka in a way. And also Kazatkina, really good week from her to get to her first semi-final at a 1,000 clay event. And, you know, she narrowly lost to Jabeur. So, yeah, it was nice to see her kind of doing really, really well and getting to that point as well. And, you know, she beat Badosa earlier in the week as well, which I think I had tipped Badosa to go deeper than that. And I mean, Sakkari as well will be kicking herself for losing that to Ongebor. I think, you know, when I saw that, I think I watched the first bit and I thought, oh, this is very one way. And I turned it off. And then I was very shocked to see that, yeah, it'd gone completely the other way in the end.
Yeah, I think Sakkari, we've said this before, but Sakkari, I feel like it's just becoming known for, you know, not being able to kind of close out matches, sort of a little bit like Emma Raducanu. But I think like Sakkari, there are matches where it feels like she is streets ahead, but something happens and the tide kind of turns completely. And, you know, in that match against Ongebor, Jabeur had absolutely no right, you know, if we're being truthful, for winning that match. And Sakkari just, you know, she just fell apart, you know, in that second set and in the third set as well. She wasn't able to, you know, she just wasn't able to kind of handle the situation. So I think there's certainly, that's something that she needs to, you know, that obviously is something she needs to kind of work on. And, you know, in order to reach semifinals, finals, who knows, maybe, you know, win a Grand Slam one day. But, you know, at the moment, there's still kind of work to be, you know, done there. And, you know, just talking about kind of Sabalenka and Kazatkina, I mean, for Sabalenka, you know, she had Anna Samova in the quarters, who's been a real problem player, I think, for Sabalenka this season. She, I think, had lost to Anna Samova in Charleston and Madrid. So it was great to see, I think, her improving, learning with each of those matches, and then actually coming out with the three-set win to get to the semi-final. But, you know, again, against Świątek for Sabalenka, a match I watched on television, she needs to play with more margin, I think, because I think with Świątek, she was hitting with the same aggression and power as Sabalenka. But because she plays with more spin, and as I said, more margin for error, she was hitting less unforced errors. Whereas I think with Sabalenka, she felt pressured, I feel, to going to the lines too much. And as a result of that, she was either hitting long or hitting wide, and it got away from her very, very quickly. And it was amazing, I think, with Świątek to see that, you know, she could beat someone like a Sabalenka so easily with, you know, that power and that aggression, and then kind of do a similar thing with Jabeur, who's, you know, completely different sort of player. And I think that's what makes Świątek so hard to beat, given, you know, she's able to kind of adapt to these different play styles and just kind of be like, yep, you play this game, that doesn't really matter because my own brand of tennis is just going to wipe the floor with you. And that is sort of where we're at the moment. And it's very, very impressive. And, you know, Jabeur in the final, great. Back-to-back finals, really, really impressive, because another player, I think she has had her critics about her fitness and, you know, her physical levels from week to week on the tour. But I think the fact that she's shown that she can get to the final in Madrid, in Rome, back-to-back weeks, very daunting schedule, I think has sort of quashed those, you know, those kind of naysayers, I think, and those doubters about the Jabeur game. Because I certainly think at the moment, if you look at everyone who's playing tennis on the WTA tour at the moment, on the clay, yes, Iga Świątek is probably, or absolutely, you know, number one kind of going into the French Open. But certainly, I think Jabeur, the way she is playing at the moment, I think she's arguably, Kim, like firm number two for me.
Mm, I was going to say, you know, she's sort of been a bit overshadowed by what Świątek's been doing. Mm. So, like, she's had her own win streak and title and, yeah, very consistent across the whole clay season. So I think underestimate her at your peril. And she's a former junior Roland Garros champion. So she's obviously at home on the clay. And I don't see any reason why she couldn't go deep at the French. So certainly I wouldn't want to be facing her in the draw as we hit the clay in Paris. But the only other thing, Joel, really that I wanted to raise today, actually, and it's been a big talking point across, you know, social media and the like, is the difference in prize money between the two draws in Rome. You know, you've got the men's and the women's tournament. Vast differences between the amount of total prize money. So for the men, it's a total prize money of €4 million. Whereas for the women, it's less than half of that. It's €1.7 million. I mean, if you look at what the winner takes home alone, the men's winner takes home over €800,000. The women's winner only takes home just over €300,000. I mean, how on earth do we have such a disparity?
Yeah.
It is shocking. You know, you're a fan, you're going perhaps to this venue or you're watching from home, and you just kind of would assume in this day and age that they would be getting paid the same, but it's not. And it's not even like a close difference. It's a vast, vast difference.
Yeah. I almost feel like that's one of the problems. I think we just assume that it's fine and we don't really think about it. But actually, when you do think about it and you look at the, you know, you look at the tournament sheets and you look at the distribution of prize money, it's still, you know, it's still a big challenge. And, you know, we have obviously got Grand Slam prize money equality, but there's still a big issue, I think, with how it's distributed on the tour. And, you know, when you've got these high profile events like, you know, Rome, which I think has been a fantastic, fantastic tournament, fantastically run. I love the fans. They're also energetic and passionate. And I think they really add to the, you know, the event. And it's got some fantastic stadia as well. But it's sort of being dragged, I think, a little bit by, you know, the prize money and how it's, you know, it's allocated and that disparity, because, you know, it just shows that they're kind of still separate entities. And, you know, we obviously, I think, want to get to a point in the future where there is more cohesion, there's more cooperation, you know, between the two tours. They operate as one. But, you know, when we see things like this, as, you know, when there's like €500,000 difference between the winner of the men's and the winner of the women's, it just feels like they're still operating in worlds apart.
Yeah, and in very old worlds, it's just 2022, you know, that just shouldn't be happening. Yeah, right. Wasn't nice to have that. I mean, it's important that someone, you know, that has been shed light on, and hopefully they all realise that, you know, there's a lot of criticism, and for next year that can be changed. But I think it's, you know, it's again the the lack of kind of cohesion between the two tours, which is a whole other story, isn't it? But I mean, just rounding up Rome as well, we had women's doubles champions Kuda Metova and Pavlyuchenkova beating friend of the podcast Gabby Dabrowski and Olmos in the final on a match tiebreak. So that was only their second event, I think, Kuda Metova and Pavlyuchenkova. So they got their first title together as a team, and you know, both very, very solid doubles players. I think Kuda Metova is like fourth in the world, so obviously bound to be a good pairing there.
It was a bit frustrating. I watched again some of the first set of that, and yeah, Dabrowski and Olmos were just running through, and I thought, oh, this could be quite a straightforward, you know, straight sets victory. And to go, you know, I think realistically it could have been, you know, at times I was thinking they could have gone, you know, back to back Madrid Rome ladies doubles champions, which is would have been a very, very impressive feat. But as you said, Pavlyuchenkova, Kudametova, very, very wily, experienced players, and were able to just sort of nab it on that championship tiebreak. So a little bit frustrating, but at the same time, very, 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 very kind of encouraging, I think, for Dabrowski and Olmos, who I think they are going to be going into the French Open ladies doubles tournament thinking, we've got a real crack here at winning a French Open title.
Yeah, they won Madrid and, you know, Rome finalists. So good luck to them in Paris. Let's take a quick break now, but do join us in the second half where we'll be having a look at the news that Wimbledon is set to lose its ranking points, that there's going to be a new WTA 1000 event in Guadalajara, and we'll look ahead to all of the draws for the last week of tournaments before the French Open. Welcome back to The Passing Shots with Joel and Kim, sponsored by DownloadTennis.com. And now we're going to move on to a par for the courts, Joel, before we get on to everything else. So I think you've got another one for me this week and for the listeners.
Yes, I do. And it's a very timely one. It is concerning Iga Świątek. And you sort of alluded to it earlier, Kim. Now I could have spoken specifically about Świątek's streak and asked you, you know, which players have been, you know, she's won as part of that streak. But I've gone a little bit broader here, and I've thought about this more in terms of like what she's achieved and kind of the record that she set and the sort of players that she is in conversation with at the moment.
Okay, so is this alluding to other win streaks, perhaps?
Exactly. Okay. So my question for you and our listeners is, as you said earlier, this week, Iga Świątek got to 25 consecutive match wins. Now, there are 9 players to have achieved that since the year 2000. There have been 5 ladies and there have been 4 men. And I would like you to tell me the tennis players who have won 25 consecutive matches since the year 2000.
Ooh,
five,
okay,
so women, five 4 women. Men. And I'm going to set the pass score at... because I was quite nice on you last week, and I think this is quite... So I'm going to say 7.
Oh, okay.
7 out of 9. I know that's quite hard, isn't it?
Is this including Świątek or
it
just
is.
9 others?
I mean,
others?
It may be, but yes.
Okay.
Yes,
I think I could get 6. I'm going to, yeah, I'll go. I think I could do 7. I'm going to say the obvious ones first. So, okay, let's do this. Right. So number 1, Iga Świątek.
Correct. Yes. Yeah.
I'll go to the men now, I think. Number 2, Roger Federer.
Correct. Yes, Roger Federer on the list. So that's 2.
3, Novak Djokovic.
Correct. Yes, he is on there also. So that's 3.
Surely Rafa has done it as well. Hopefully.
Correct. Yes, I'm surprised that wasn't the your second answer behind Świątek. Well... But yes, yeah, Nadal also on the list. So yeah, the big 3 from the ATP tour: Federer, Nadal, Djokovic. Yeah, on the list.
So I'll go back to the women now, I think. I'm going to say Serena Williams.
Correct. Yes, Serena Williams is on there. So you've got two of the five women and three of the four men. So that is five total. So you need two more, Kim, for par for the courts.
So I think because of all the Swiatek stuff, I've seen some stats on social media. I'm sure that this person has been listed, and that's Justine Henin, I should say.
Justine Henin?
Yeah.
Correct. Yes. Woo. Justine Henin is on the list. Henin did 25 consecutive wins. So yeah, that is six. So you need, Kim, it's tense situation now. One more for consecutive par for the courts. You could have your own par for the courts win streak.
Yeah. Or I could just get it hopelessly wrong. I've got a few players that I'm banding around in my head. So I mean, on the women's side, I've got...
You've got one man or three...
And two women.
Sorry, two women, yes. One man or two women you could potentially go for.
So I know Osaka had a long win streak recently or a few years ago, but was that 25? And maybe Venus Williams at the very start of the millennium had one. Or so they're the two women that I'm thinking of. But on the men's side, that's difficult. I mean, could Andy Murray have had a win streak that long? He'd surely be one of the only other, unless it's something like Leighton Hewitt. Oh, okay. I'm going to go.
I'm going to have to hurry you, Kim.
Sorry.
I'm
going to go for Osaka. That's my next guess.
Osaka?
Yeah.
Incorrect, Kim.
Oh, no.
Incorrect. You have fallen short.
She did have a win streak, though, but obviously not 25.
She
matches.
Did, but it did not get to 25 wins. And you're going to hate me for what I'm going to say next, because if you had said Andy Murray, you would have been correct. And if you had said Venus Williams, you would have been correct. Yeah. So, yes. But there is one other player who has also reached 25 consecutive match wins. So we had Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Murray on the men's side. Venus Williams, Serena Williams, Justine Henin, Iga Swiatek on the women's side, along with Victoria Azarenka.
Oh, well done, Vika. Okay. I probably wouldn't have guessed her, actually. So I didn't quite make it this week, but came close.
Listeners, that was so close, Kim. That was so close. That could have been like two consecutive par for the court victories.
Oh, could have had two trophies. There we go. Not to be. Let's go on to our mailbag for the week, Joel, which actually you've submitted your own question to the mailbag.
Yes. Yes. Which, I don't care about our listeners.
Is that allowed?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I've got a question. It actually came up in commentary, which I thought was really interesting kind of debate from Mark Petchy on Prime. And he was talking about kind of new ball changes, because, you know, obviously at the moment, you know, it dictates it's like, you know, after seven games and then nine games, da, 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 da. But he suggested that should new ball changes in matches be based on time instead of number of games? Because his rationale was, you know, particularly on clay, you know, a number of games, it could take, you know, seven games could take 20 minutes, but on clay, given the nature of the surface, it could take also up to, you know, 40-50 minutes. I think, you know, the match Swiatek had against Azarenka, the first seven games took a very, 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 very long time. And is there, you know, a deficiency in, you know, defining ball changes by number of games and whether it should be on a timed basis, which I thought was quite an interesting sort of interesting line of argument.
Yeah, I totally see his point, because, you know, some games can be 20 minutes long and obviously the balls would be a lot more worn much quicker than if you have seven very, very quick games of a lot of aces, for example. So maybe they could work out an average time that it would take from looking at a you know, a summary of certain matches, the sample, and come to some kind of, yeah, generalized rule. But I mean, would that mean though, if you're in the middle of a game and the clock hits 20 minutes, you're suddenly like, oh, hang on a minute, stop what you're doing and we'll change the balls.
Yeah, because obviously the time on court is, it accounts for changeovers and, you know, medical timeouts and not everything. And obviously games is a lot easier to do, more practical, I feel like, on, yeah, as you said, you can do it on the odd game kind of changeover. So I feel like it's something that needs to be sort of worked out there, but I'm not against it in principle. No. And I think, you know, it is something, it's more obvious, I feel, on a clay court. I just, you know, I feel naturally on grass, for example, the difference between, you know, what seven games could take at the top end and the bottom end is going to be a lot closer together than say on a clay court, where, as I said, it could be really quick. It could be, you know, 40 love, 40 love, 40 love, etc. But it also could be really, really long, because generally speaking, the length of the rally is longer. So I certainly think it's something that could be looked at, maybe just on a clay court. I don't know, but yeah, it feel like any of these sorts of things, Kim, just chuck it into the next gen finals and see if it works or not.
There's always a test bed for innovation. So I think, I mean, you could always have a separate clock which just records the actual playing time.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I just wouldn't want it to disrupt the flow of the match if you suddenly got to a point, you know. So maybe they could say, oh, it's the next change of ends after X time had been reached. But yeah, I think that's certain. I think it's a very interesting argument. It's not something I'd thought of before, but it does make a lot of sense. So well done to Mark Petchy for getting our thoughts, you know, in motion on that one. But yeah, listeners, we won't ignore your mailbag questions every week. So do keep sending them in. Joel will have to learn to wait.
Yeah, I'll be quiet next week.
We do have some talking points though, Joel, this week, namely the ranking points saga for Wimbledon and also the grass court events in the UK in the run-up to Wimbledon. So basically, as a result of Wimbledon and the LTA banning Russian and Belarusian players from all of the grass court events in the UK, rumour has it that ATP, like Player Council, are not happy and they want to take action against this kind of ban, because they fundamentally believe it's not right to ban people from competing due to what their governments are doing. So I guess a sort of punishment for Wimbledon and the LTA events is that there won't be any ranking points awarded to any of these events, and that's going to impact on, you know, players wanting to play these tournaments. They'll just go off and they won't play Queens, for example. They'll go off and play Halle if they can get in. I mean, you can't have everyone sort of jumping ship to the continent because there isn't enough spaces there. But what do you make of all of this? Do you think it's going to go ahead? Do you think it's a good move?
Well, I think it has to go ahead if you're the ATP, and given your stance is completely at odds with the stance that Wimbledon has taken. I think you have to make a stand in some sort of way, and ranking points feels like the most obvious way to do that. And you know, if that does happen, I don't think it's gonna make a big difference at Wimbledon, in the sense of I can't see players dropping out, given, you know, the prestige of Wimbledon. It's a Grand Slam. Also, the prize money at play at Wimbledon in Grand Slams in general, it's just so massive that it just feels like I don't think players would drop out. It'd just be a bit annoying. But I certainly think it's more of an issue potentially with the British tour events, like, you know, Queens, Eastbourne, these events where they're in competition with events outside of the UK. You know, I mean, I guess I get that kind of the entry list is sort of coming out now. I think Queens potentially is coming out tomorrow, but, you know, we saw the entry list for Halle, and I was looking at it and thinking that it's pretty stacked. You know, Medvedev's there, Rublev's there, Tsitsipas is there, Zverev is there, and I wondered if it was sort of playing on their minds in terms of, well, I don't want to miss out on potential ranking points, so, you know, I'd rather be certain about that, play Halle, than, you know, what, you know, what, than not know what is going to be happening at Queen's. But I certainly think out of principle, the ATP, and I'm assuming also that the WTA, which I feel like I haven't heard what their kind of stance on it, but I feel like they need to come together and decide on that. And they've got to come together, I think, pretty quickly, because these are still kind of rumors. They're, you know, they're not, it's not official yet, but it, you know, the grass court season is very much on the horizon now. And, you know, I think players will want to know, in order, you know, for their scheduling, what, you know, what they want to do. But yeah, I think out of principle and where they stand, I think they have to sort of go down this approach.
Yeah, they need to do it pronto, because these events start in a few weeks. And I think it would make sense, obviously, for ATP and WTA to both do the same. I think it would be silly to have one and not the other. And I think the WTA also came out and said that they generally disagree with what Wimbledon and the LTA have done. So I think they would probably follow suit. I mean, two of the players you mentioned for Halle, though, Joel, they've got to play Halle because they can't come to the UK, Medvedev and Rublev.
That is very true.
There will be a lot of players who obviously have to play those events. But yeah, I mean, I think that what Wimbledon and the LTA have done, you know, I disagree with it. I don't think it's fair to ban these players. So I do think that they're, you know, it's their kind of just desserts to have some kind of stand put against that. You know, the ATP owns the ranking system, even if Wimbledon is obviously a Grand Slam and independent from the ATP. So the ATP can still control those ranking points. I don't think, yeah, it's going to affect too many players actually going to Wimbledon, because obviously prize money and just it being a Grand Slam and many people's like favourite tournament. I think it's the other events, isn't it? And I mean, I guess the prize money is still going to be a lure for a lot of players, but it's a shame, you know, even for if this does go ahead, if a, I don't know, up and coming British player does really well, they could have really benefited from those points. So, you know, a lot of players could. So the LTA might have shot themselves in the foot to some extent if we, you know, our own players don't benefit as well. So we'll have to see what happens and comes out in the next week on this one, because I, as you said, a decision would need to be made very, very quickly, so that you know, everyone can kind of make those arrangements. But yeah, I think it's a lot. It does make sense, I think, if they were to do it.
Yeah, I think if you're the ATP or the WTA, you don't, you come out and say we stand against what Wimbledon have said, but then don't really kind of follow on from that. It's sort of more like a sort of just sort of a state of disapprovingment or whatever. There's no real sort of action taken, and you know, I think players probably would obviously get kind of frustrated by it, but you know, if they really firmly believe that, you know, they are fully against what, you know, Wimbledon have said, and you know, given that what we've seen in the past, they absolutely are, then I think they have to make an action to stand by that they can hang their hat on. And yeah, I think ranking point deductions, they make sense. You know, we'll have to see. I don't think it'll change the kind of competitive nature of Wimbledon. I know there will be people who kind of will come out and say, oh, well, that would make Wimbledon just a glorified exhibition. I think just because of the prestige and the history of the Grand Slam, I think, you know, I don't think it's going to feel like that. But again, it does, I think, create a little different kind of complexion potentially, you know, on how the tournament goes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in other news, Joel, we have Guadalajara is set to host a Masters 1000 event for the women in, I think, October, as a replacement for the equivalent event that used to be out in Wuhan and Beijing. So obviously the WTA continuing with their boycotting of events in China. But you know, this is good news for Guadalajara, because they held the WTA finals last year, and it was a great event.
Great.
Packed crowds, really fun event. So I'm pleased that they're getting a 1000 event. I think it's hopefully going to be another great week on the tour.
Yeah, definitely. I think we were sort of talking about this at the end of last season, how, you know, it was such a fun tournament, even given that it was sort of quite makeshift, and, you know, it was all felt a little bit like last minute, but at the same time, it was expertly put on. There were big crowds there. And I think that for me was the sort of the most sort of appealing nature, I think, of Guadalajara, in the sense of, I think we do get tournaments in Asia, and particularly tournaments on the tour where you just see on the TV screens just lots of empty seats and players playing in less than 50% full arenas. But I certainly think with Guadalajara, yeah, they just absolutely love their tennis out there, and it's great to see them get a really big, juicy event. And I think the organizers will be absolutely looking forward to that and filling a real kind of prize spot, I think, on the on the WTA tour, and moving off, weaning the WTA off this Asia dependency, and as a result, it feels like there's an opportunity there for another part of the world to get involved, and it looks like South America is going to benefit.
Yeah, and last but not least, we've got some other news, tennis business news, I guess, is that Naomi Osaka has left IMG to set up her own agency called Evolve. So she's doing her own thing. She's going to try and grow her continually growing, I guess, portfolio of sponsors and deals and what have you, and but do it with her own company, which I think... I think other players have done in the past, and IMG are a massive, massive company, aren't they? They represent a lot of sports stars and tennis players, but she wants to do it herself and continue growing in that fashion. So good luck to her.
Quite interesting sort of move, but as you said, it's a move, I think, that it makes sense. She's very... she's a very high profile character. We've seen other high profile, not just tennis stars, but sports stars go down a similar route. Roger Federer, but also people like LeBron James as well, from basketball, Steph Curry. So, I think it's interesting. She's taking more ownership. And I always think like she's quite a creative person. She's quite interesting. I feel like she's got some sort of interesting sort of ventures. I think we've already sort of seen them out there, and I think this is an interesting kind of approach to take, but something that is, I think, in line with what other kind of sports stars who I feel like transcend their sport are doing. And it sort of makes sense. I hope it doesn't obviously kind of distract from her her tennis and being on the tennis court, but I think certainly kind of moving forward it works for her in terms of her that ownership and being able to kind of own yourself a bit more. And I think, we've seen that in the past with, I think, as I said, players like Roger Federer doing that, taking that approach. And great to see.
Yeah, good luck to her. I didn't realize this, but she set up her own skincare company last year called Kineo. So I didn't know that, but obviously she wants to get a lot more things underway. So fantastic, and wish her well. Which brings us on to looking at this week ahead and tennis, because we've got four events, all 250s prior to the French Open. So on the men's side of things, we've got Geneva and Lyon as well. And we've got Strasbourg and Morocco for the women. So, I mean, let's just have a quick look at each of these draws. I think Medvedev is headlining in Geneva, but also Casper Ruud, who is there as the defending champion, and obviously did very well in Rome. So, interesting that Medvedev's back. I assume he's ready to get going again, which is good to see. Hasn't been on court for a while, so it'll be interesting to see how he gets on. And Dominic Thiem is also there, hoping to get that first victory since coming back. I think he's got, has he got Cecchinato
qualifier
in the first round?
Yep. Quite tricky one, that. But I think Dominic Thiem, he's getting a bit better and better by the match. So I think there's grounds for optimism as well for Daniel Medvedev. I think, I mean, I have not no idea, Kim, what Medvedev we should be seeing on the court. Clay's not his, I feel like, most natural surface. I feel like at times he has a very much a mostly hate relationship with clay, but he is a very, he's like the number two in the world. So I'm sort of curious to see how he goes in Geneva and what you know, and based on that, what sort of expectation or if any expectation we can put on him, you know, at the French Open, because he is one of those players we've just not really, you know, been speaking about. We just thought, honestly, that he wasn't even going to play the French Open. Those were sort of the mutterings, I think, a few weeks ago. But it's great to see him back on the tour. I mean, this is a fun little tournament, I think, with Casper Ruud as the second seed. Yeah, I think quite competitive. Denis Shapovalov is also there after that, you know, victory against Rafa. So it's going to be I think that's going to be quite a competitive one. Leon as well, Kim. Cam Norrie is the top seed. This draw, arguably, probably a little bit kind of lighter on the big names, but you still got Gael Monfils, who's going to be a dad. Lina Svitolina, has announced that she is with child today. She is pregnant.
Exciting, because she pulled out of the French Open, stating that, you know, she wasn't in a right sort of mental state to play. But obviously, you know, what with the war going on, that's understandable. But perhaps also it's due to the baby news. So yeah, really pleased for both of them. I think it's due in October, baby girl. But yeah, Monfils is out in Lyon. Cam Norrie is the top seed. PCB also there. Songa's got a wild card. So
Holger Rune unseeded. I feel like he's quite a dangerous guy to potentially watch. So yeah, looking at him, obviously with the Brits as well, Cam Norrie. I think Songa also in on a wild card on his route to retirement at the French Open. So yeah, he's got quite a tricky one, I feel, against Alex Molcan in the first round. So yeah, we'll see how all of those get on. And on the WTA side as well, we've got Strasbourg and Morocco, Kim. Strasbourg, Karolina Pliskova there as the top seed on a wild card. Angie Kerber also there on a wild card as the second seed. Elise Mertens, Sloane Stephens, Sorana Castella. And curiously, Sam Stosur.
Yeah, what is she doing there? I thought she'd given up singles, but she's there on a wild card playing Harmony Tam, which I think was happening today.
Yeah, she was there on a wild card, I think is the correct tense, given the result earlier. Yeah, basically. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Sorry, Joel. I know how much of a fan you are of her. But yeah, I mean, fair play. I think she won this event before, so maybe it's because she's a previous champion and she's just like, yeah, I'll take a wild card. Why not? Heather Watson's also there, so see what she can do. But then we've also got the tournament in Rabat. Muguruza is top seed there, and Tomljanovic is the second seed. So, yeah, not as I guess as many high profile names in Morocco. But Muguruza will be hoping to find some form because it's gone a bit AWOL of late.
Yeah, I get the feeling a lot of top players have taken wild cards into the last round of tournaments before the French Open, who have not necessarily had the clay season they were hoping. Yeah, Muguruza, Pliskova, particularly on the women's side. But yeah, we will see how they get on. I mean, Muguruza's got what looks like quite a nice draw with quite a few qualifiers and lucky losers surrounding her. So we'll see how she gets on in Morocco. But yeah, that is the end of our catch-up, Kim. We're going to be back for our French Open preview, which is going to be on next episode. Roland Garros is just around the corner. So I hope listeners can join us for that later on next week. I'm not sure quite when the draw is coming out, but we'll let people know on social media. We do actually have a little bit of a bonus with this episode, because listeners, you may know Chris, who I went to the Billie Jean King Cup with. We were going to go to Rome for the Italian Open this season. Unfortunately, I was not able to go. But Chris has gone out there and he's done a little diary by himself. So I'm going to leave it at the end of the episode after the music. So if you want to hear a little bit about Rome on the ground from Chris, and you know what it's like as a fan and the matches he saw, then listen on.
Absolutely. And yeah, as Joel said, we'll be back before Roland Garros, looking ahead to the second Grand Slam of the year. I can't believe it's here already. And we go into this sort of epic phase of the season where, you know, we then have the grass court starting straight after, and it's all a bit hectic and everything's, you know, going on in the UK. So yeah, it's a fun time, isn't it?
If only there was some sort of catch up podcast that helped tennis fans just make the most. Yeah. No, listeners, listeners, I hope you enjoyed listening to this latest catch up with The Passing Shot. Remember to subscribe to us to stay up to date on all the action coming up, including the French Open, Roland Garros in Paris, later on this month. You can subscribe to us on whatever device you listen to us on. We are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all good podcasting platforms out there. You can also listen to us on the DownloadTennis.com app. And if you like what you're hearing, then make sure to leave us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
And you can follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Passing Shot Pod. So if you don't already follow us, do give us a follow and a like, and tell all your friends about us as well as we go into the busiest stage of the tennis season, especially at home in the UK. We're also on email, so you can contact us on there as well, passingshotpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out our website as well, www.thepassingshot.co.uk.
And we will be back next time at Passing Shot HQ for our Roland Garros preview. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from Kim.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. We will see you again soon. Listeners, here it is, Passing Shot Extra. Chris is here to give you the download on the Italian Open. If you're ever thinking about going, or you just want to hear what it's like being in the stadium, Chris has got the point of view that you would probably want to listen to. So yeah, listen on to hear about his kind of perspective, the matches he saw. And yeah, if you're ever thinking about going as a fan, this is the guide you want to hear. So I'll leave it over to Chris. And we will see you. We will see you for our French Open preview later on next week.
Well, hello. Greetings from sunny Rome, where it's been around 30 degrees all week. So I'm not sure how the players have coped. But Joel asked me to record an update from Rome. I've been here all week watching the tennis. And I thought I could give you an overview as to what it's like to attend the tennis as a spectator, but also give you a snapshot of some of the matches that I saw and some of the takes from the matches that I saw. So, as a tournament, Rome is very different to other tennis tournaments that I've been to. The French Open and Wimbledon are a lot more classy, I would say, in terms of not too much alcohol consumed. It's not big, loud music in between games, and it's very much more of a civilized affair. But Rome is about having a great time, the tournament. It is fun, there's lots of alcohol consumed, people are there, might not be tennis fans, but they are looking to have a great time, and so the atmosphere is incredible. A lot of beer is consumed, unsurprisingly a lot of pizza is eaten, not a single fruit or a strawberry on offer, but it was a fantastic experience and a fantastic vibe. Lots of dancing in stands, which is something that I also don't think they encourage at Wimbledon. So I cannot recommend, if you're looking to have a great time at a tennis tournament, I don't think you'd be able to beat Rome. And something that I would say is also really interesting is that the kind of Italian fans of tennis, they love to support whoever is behind. They want a close match, they want a great match. So someone might be passionately cheering for one player 1 point before, and then suddenly it all shifts almost that quickly. So I think it's great to see the passion they have for a great match of tennis, not necessarily for an individual player. And I think that's something that makes for some very entertaining matches and crowd interactions. And they love to get involved when it comes to a dodgy line call. They are happy to tell you what they think, especially if the umpire might be getting it wrong or an Italian is playing. So I'll give you an overview of some of the matches that we saw. We were there Wednesday to Friday, and at the time of recording, I have not watched the finals. I will catch up on that. So anything I'm saying, I will caveat, I do not know what's happened. But on the first day, we went to an evening session, and these start very late in Rome. They are, I think it's local time 7, but one of Nadal's evening sessions started at 8 p.m. For the evening session that I went to, it was an all-Italian affair of Sinner versus Fognini. and it was a hot day in Rome. The crowd was very lively. It was fully packed, and it was dramatic from the start. Fognini started limping on the first point and called the trainer out, and we thought maybe this would be a very short affair, but I think maybe he likes the drama of it. I don't want to say that he was faking, but he then played three full sets. He won the second set, but I think potentially it was to kind of get the crowd involved a little bit of dramatic improvisation. But it was a great match. I think I felt a bit bad for Sinner in the sense that because Fognini had drawn the crowd in with his injury and kind of the fact he wasn't playing very well at all in the first set, it really gave him the oomph he needed to improve, whereas Sinner was pretty, you know, couldn't tell what he was thinking, kept a level head throughout. But I do think that Fognini played the better tennis, but not the most consistent tennis. And I think something, this is could be contentious, but Fognini's backhand down the line is probably one of the best I've ever seen. I think it's unbelievable how he's able to change direction. And it's something that was quite clearly missing from part of Sinner's game, in the sense that Sinner was not taking line. He was very much going back cross court, paying the percentages, and hoping that Fognini missed. And that was a great match to experience with an Italian crowd, probably one of the most Italian or kind of culturally specific things I've ever witnessed in terms of Italians cheering on Italians in Italy. So that was a great first match. And then I have to confess, for the Badosa fans out there, we did skip the Badosa-Sasnovich match because we thought maybe Badosa would have that quite easily. And we went to Pietrangeli to watch Danielle Collins, who Joel and I have spoken about before. We are big fans. And she was playing against Simona Halep. And that match was a very close first set where Collins was sort of struggling for form a little bit, and it was becoming a bit of a tussle. And it was fantastic to see that she was broken for 6-5 and she was visibly livid. She didn't sit down at change of end. She just waited at the baseline for the next point to start for all of the changeover. And after she lost that game at 6-5 and was broken, she was on one. Something changed. She was so furious with herself that she decided that all she was going to do was hit winners. And she essentially hit Simona Halep off the court. It was interesting watching Simona, now under kind of the coaching of Patrick Mortoglou. He was there. And I think it will be interesting to see what he can do, because Simona obviously doesn't have the same weapons as Serena. And it was quite clear that she could be hit off the court. And if she's missing a little bit and her game is built around kind of retrieving balls, putting pressure on, she's technically brilliant. She was exposed when Daniela Collins just decided to hit through her. So that was a great match to watch. And then on the next day, we were watching Jessica Pegula, who we were excited to see, versus Sabalenka on grandstand. And that was a court that I personally prefer to central court. I think it's something that is more comfortable. It's less kind of gladiatorial and much more relaxed. So I think that's a great court. If you have a ticket for that, it will be a great day. You don't have to get a ticket for Central, because they do split the matches between the two. So it's always really good matches on both. And Pegula, Madrid finalist, was taking on Sabalenka. And I have to say, it was one of the most disappointing starts to a match I've ever seen. It was like something was really wrong with Jessie Pegula. I was cheering her on, trying to get her going. But she really could not get anything going. And Sabalenka played pretty solidly, but Pegula just did not show up. And it's something that we saw quite a lot throughout the week, is that I'm not sure if it's going from some of the different conditions of playing, like a night match on a much cooler temperature, to a day match where the surface is very, very dry and it's hard to slide. I'm not sure what it is, but a lot of players really didn't show up in the first set. And then it kind of set the tone for the matches. And this was true for Pegula, who somehow managed to get to 6-4 in the second, but that was a straight sets loss and a big disappointment. Flashes of Sabalenka brilliance, and you wonder why she hasn't gone further. I still wonder that, especially after Iga's able to dismantle her game so easily when she has such a big game. It's kind of surprising. So we then saw a bit of Garin versus Cilic. Garin is a great chap in terms of he gives everything on every point. I don't mean that to sound patronising. I think he's just very positive. He never gives it a free point. I think that was testament to how he was able to get that victory in 3 hours against Cilic. We moved over to one of my personal favourites, Bianca, Andreescu, who was playing out on court one, another great court that's unticketed, playing its Petra Martic. And I'd say that was probably some of the most competitive and kind of engaging tennis matches we saw. That was a 6-4, 6-4 win, lots of variety. And unfortunately for Petra Martic, I think she's had this sort of problem before. Mentally, she should go away a bit at key moments. But it was great to see BB back on the court and up close. We checked out Tsitsipas Khachanov after that. And again, so disappointing how someone can win a set 6-4 and then couldn't get the ball in the court. And I think it seems to be true for a lot of players that they either are hitting at full force, going for winners, or they kind of inch back, get behind that baseline, and then they play too defensively. And so that was a big shame that he wasn't able to show up. And I mean, the 6-3 that he did get in the final set, it wasn't competitive. So that was a big shame. And then similar theme, a big shame, Collins and Isimova. She was dismantled and didn't seem like herself at all. And I couldn't believe that the night before, we'd seen her absolutely dominate Simona Halep. And again, I don't know what the reason is for that. Could be the conditions, could be something going on. But clearly it's very hard to get your best out of you on a day-to-day basis. And that could be because of the changing conditions. I really do not know. But it was surprising to see, that's for sure. We checked out some of Sakari Goff, which was a lot of unforced errors. Sakari did have chances to serve it out when she was a break up. She was a break up early on in the second set. And not necessarily the best front runner there, but that was a little bit messy. And then we checked out some of the Ons match against Putintseva, which Ons was on fire. So that was great to see her after a Madrid win and how exciting her game is. And there are so many passionate Tunisian fans. So that was fantastic to see how proud they are of her and how well she's doing. And people were wearing kind of all red. Someone was in a onesie and it's not cold at all. So the commitment of the Tunisian fans was something to be admired. And then on the Friday, we saw a bit of Sasha versus Garin again. And that was one where Sasha was playing well. Garin does have weapons, but he does tend to play a little bit more defensive. And a lot of players we saw kind of started like going for it. And if it didn't work, they then reverted to plan B, which is obviously retrieval. And Sasha, when he hits the ball, it is pretty impressive. And he played very well in that match overall. But I do think he could take on the ball a bit more than he does. But that was very enjoyable. Then the highlight of the day, what I was really looking forward to, was Iga versus Bianca. And that's first set could have gone either way. I really think that Bianca could have got it. She was a break up at times, she was a breakdown at times, but there was a turning point in the tiebreak where there was an awful decision by the umpire on a ball that was called, I think it was one that was called out and was in, and then they made, no, it was called, yeah, it was in, and then they said to they had to replay the point. In fact, ignore all of that. It wasn't replay the point. It was awarded to Iga, and Bianca had to play on the ball. And that really set the tone for the tiebreak, unfortunately. And then that match was obviously kind of very unfortunate in the way that it was a 6-love second set. But good to see Bianca back. Good to see her be able to be competitive, even if it is just for the one set. And I mean, against Iga, if you get any games, you're doing well these days. And then the final match that we watched was Ons Jabeur versus Sakari. And Ons did not turn up. It was almost the Collins effect. Could not believe that she couldn't find the court. And I was with my auntie, who thought that maybe she could have a better go. And it was that sort of level of, you weren't sure what happened in the first few points that would make someone so kind of despondent and kind of unable to engage with the situation they're in. And she went down 6-1 and 5-2. And then Sakari went into meltdown. And we've seen it happen before at the French and a few other places where she just almost, something goes off in her brain and she can't necessarily find the court or make the same decisions. So that was a big shame in that one, because we didn't necessarily get a period where they were both playing well. From 5-2, Ons took it 7-5, and then the third set was very, very plain sailing. But kind of overall thoughts was that Rome is a fantastic tournament to visit. I cannot recommend it enough. It's great, even if you aren't necessarily the most informed tennis fan, you will still be able to see some fantastic tennis with an amazing atmosphere. And something that I was really surprised by, and I've talked about already in this, is how people aren't able to bring their best game each day. And I've seen that not really as present at other tournaments, like at Wimbledon, maybe because it's a bigger tournament, and the French Open, even if you aren't having a good day, it's a Grand Slam. It's as big as the tournament and sport gets. So you find a way. But it looked like people were struggling for motivation. It could be to do with the conditions being so warm. It could be the changing scheduling that could be causing some of the problems. But that was very disappointing to see. But fantastic to see Iga up close. That was a personal highlight. Seeing Iga in full flight, especially in that second set against Bianca, she was unplayable. But overall, fantastic week in Rome. Next time, I hope you join me, Joel. I think we'll have a fantastic time. Yeah, and enjoy some of that party atmosphere at the Foro Italico.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.